Okay, good morning. Let's get started. We're on Chaf Aleph Amud Bet toward the bottom, four lines up. I only handed out Chaf Bet, so I'll read for you the bottom few lines of that end of that daf. As we are now in the third perek, we last time began the first perek, which started on Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, and we suggested that we have transitioned in terms of our emphasis. The first chapter was devoted to the importance of instilling hope in a community if it is to have a sense of its own future and survival. The second chapter was devoted to what we call the medium of memory, how human beings, how hope is transmitted to human beings by the means of repeating important elements of history, giving them a sense of self and a sense of past. We said the order is important when you're presenting the Megillah or Hallel or Kriyat Shema or Tefillah or any human process where you intend to inspire. Chronology is important as you're transmitting information. We said not only is order important, language is important, the language in which it's transmitted. And we said the bearer of the message is important. You can't have a child who's not aware of what they're doing just parroting. You have to have somebody who is conscious of what they're saying or at least capable of understanding it, presenting it. And that was the second chapter, and we transitioned to the third chapter, which now has this premise that in diaspora, we have very limited power. As a religious institutional body, as religious Jews, rabbis are confessing, we don't have power to keep people in their seats. We can't penalize people if they leave the shul. We can't kind of set standards that we can expect the public to adhere to. We're in a position where we have to entice them. We have to capture their attention. We have to generate interest on the part of the public. And how do we do that in a way that doesn't sell out the substance of Jewish life? You know, we could just make everything happy, candy, clappy, and, you know, make everybody want to be there the whole time. But then you lose the sobriety. You lose what's important. And you want to give a sense that you're not here just because I'm, you know, giving you carrots all the time, although that wouldn't attract anybody. But I am... you're here because this is important. So how do we strike this balance between we want to make sure that people are included and we are an inclusive space that anybody can walk in and make sure that there is some solemnity to the experience that doesn't make it feel like a free-for-all. And that's where we started with the Mishnah last time, which was the Megillah needs to be read can be read sitting or standing. There's a lot of flexibility about whether you have one person reading, two reading simultaneously, there can be a harmony. And the implication that Gemara took from that is that's true for Megillah, but that's not true for Laning. And the understanding was, why can you have all this flexibility around Megillah but not around Laning? What is different about Megillah? Right, which we translate roughly as it's interesting. It's beloved by people. So people are going to be there for the Megillah anyway. You've already got enough candies and carrots available that there's some flexibility built into the sobriety. It's beloved, meaning people already respect it, maybe is another way to look at it. People are already going to give it its due. But you get to a regular piece of laning on an average week. It's not chaviv, it sounds like. It's not naturally a matter of interest or respect or affection to people, and we need to give a sense of sobriety, which is why when you're laning in front of the community, you have to be on your feet. You have to stand. Give it a sense of reverence. You can't have more than one person reading at the same time because people are going to lose their focus and not pay attention. And that's where we started last time. And the rest of the Mishnah, which we'll be dealing with today, is... how many people get called to an aliyah? Seems like this should be a relatively settled question, but we're now debating, well, on a regular day of laning, you should have three people having aliyah. When it's not a regular day, when it's Rosh Chodesh, you should have four people. When it's Yom Tov, you should have five. Yom Kippur, you should have six. Shavuot, you should have seven. And then we'll get into, well, there's one kind of day that isn't disclosed in the Mishnah. So we've got the regular Monday, Thursday laning. We've got Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed laning. We've got Yom Tov laning, Yom Kippur laning, and Shabbos laning, but there is an unusual day that isn't featured here, and that is a public fast day. How many aliyahs do you have in a fast day? And one of the answers to that is?
Three.
But we're now going to debate, because it's not mentioned in the Mishnah. Is this like a Monday, Thursday, should be like 3? Or is it like a Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, where it should be 4? It's not discussed. And it sounds like the fact that they only state Monday, Thursday is 3, or Rosh Chodesh, Chol HaMoed is 4, that they're trying to imply that nothing else has that. So where does the fast day fall? And that's what we'll spend a lot of time debating. But the first thing we're going to deal with, on the bottom of Chaf Aleph Amud Bet, is something that, to this day, I imagine, strikes many of us as odd at least once a month. Which is, you get to Leining for Rosh Chodesh, you read Rishon, and then what happens in Sheni?
So it's somewhere
else. You go back, and you start again. So you end up repeating a verse, which is very strange, or unusual, we should say. And that's where we're going to begin today. And it sounds like this is an arcane, technical, practical debate about how to divide up verses. But beneath the surfaces, again, this theme we've said is going to be the premise of this chapter, which is, how do we design a space to be inclusive when we know we can't hold people captive, while also giving a sense of reverence and not making it sound like we're trying to just appeal to the public? And that's the concern. So there is, to get through this piece in one piece, three rules we need to bear in mind when it comes to laning that are going to be necessary to navigate to make this work. Number one, every aliyah has to be at least 3 psukim. So that's straightforward, 3 psukim at least. Number two, there is an assumption that there are paragraphs in the Torah. So when you get an aliyah, you'll see there are sometimes gaps, like elongated gaps between words. That's the designation, there's a new paragraph. So every aliyah has to have 3 psukim. Second rule is, you cannot finish a paragraph with less than 3 psukim left. Because the assumption there is, if somebody needs to leave, and there's only 2 psukim left of that paragraph, and they need to leave, they're going to go out. And what are they going to go out thinking? Oh, the next aliyah is just going to be 2 psukim. There's only 2 psukim left of that paragraph. So they're going to leave, not knowing that you should have 3 psukim. And again, this is what John mentioned last time. This is, the rabbis care? Like, if he's leaving the middle of laning, number one, why are we, like, setting up standards to worry about somebody who's leaving when they shouldn't be leaving? Number one. And number two, how frequently does this happen? It seems like a very far-fetched concern to structure laning and go through all the manipulative navigations we're about to do as to how, why you end up repeating yourself in the middle of laning is in case people walk out with a misimpression. And we said last time, correct, it is odd, but Chazal essentially saying, we are hyper-concerned. We're in the diaspora, we don't have control. People can leave and come and go as they please from shul. How do we make sure there isn't confusion? How do we maintain tradition when we don't have a grip on the public? And we're very concerned that someone's going to leave with the wrong impression. And number one, we're worried about them. But we're also willing to make everybody else contort themselves into pretzels in order to accommodate them. So if you were putting this on a scale of insularity or kiruv, on the other hand, it seemed to be Chazal leaning, erring on the side of kiruv, meaning we want to make sure people understand what's happening for the sake of tradition and for the sake of the public. Okay. So, the problem with Rosh Chodesh is, how many aliyahs on Rosh Chodesh? 4. There are only 3 paragraphs with those breaks in the laning for Rosh Chodesh. And there is an assumption that you can't read any material on a day that isn't related to the day. So you can't go beyond those 3 paragraphs. It's not related to Rosh Chodesh anymore. So 3 paragraphs. The first has 8 psukim. The second has 2 psukim. And the third has 5 psukim. So, bless you. The last paragraph, you can have 1 aliyah. That's more than 3. Not a problem. The middle paragraph is 2, which means you can't have somebody have an aliyah of just that on its own. And the first has 8. So the question is, how do you divide the 8 and the 2? So you're going to have 3 aliyahs happening there with everybody getting a minimum of 3 without stopping a paragraph with less than 3 left and without starting a paragraph without starting a paragraph with less than 3 in total. Did we do all 3 rules or we only did the 2? Okay, so again, everyone has to have 3 psukim in their aliyah. Number 2, you can't finish a paragraph with less than 3 remaining. Number 3, I don't know if we said it out loud. Number 3 was, you can't begin a paragraph without doing at least 3. You have to make sure that you do more than 3 when you start a paragraph. Otherwise, it looks like to people who are coming in, they come in and they see that you stopped 2 psukim in, said, oh, I missed the opening, I just got here, and they stopped 2 psukim into the paragraph. Presumably, you only did 2 psukim, so you only need 2. So that's ha-nichnasim, that's your word about people coming in late, and your word about people leaving early. And we're now going to entertain, are those worries on the same level? If I'm forced to decide about whether I'm more worried, I don't have a choice. The only two options available are, it's going to give a misimpression to people leaving, or it's going to give a misimpression to people coming early. Who am I more worried about? And that's also going to be a question of, as I'm designing my space and thinking about Jewish ritual life and transmission, am I concerned about people who are leaving early or people who are coming in late? Now, which one is more inclusive? Worrying about people who are leaving early? Who would you want to bend the service less to? People who are leaving early or people who are coming late?
People coming late.
Oh, interesting. People coming late. That's interesting. Right, and coming late is a signal that it's, you know, people, I remember in high school, they say, you wouldn't come late if you had a meeting with the king. No one ever gave me an opportunity to meet with the king, and it's possible I would be a few minutes late. But people, I say, you know, if it was that important, you wouldn't come late. I guess leaving early is an understandable frustration. So it's interesting. And we're going to entertain as we go through this daf, why, what's more likely? Is it more likely people are going to come late or leave early? And right, and the assumption the Gemara does take is it's probably more likely once people are there, they're not going to leave. You know, the rule of momentum is people are going to stay where they are, but people coming late, that's more frequent. There's also a possibility if somebody gets a misimpression when they leave, that's a more problematic reality than if someone gets a misimpression when they come for another reason. Well, either they make different assumption, or they'll talk to their neighbor, which is the assumption of what people do in shul anyway. They'll say, oh, what happened? Where did they start the laning from? You've got a public to discuss with. If they leave, they're out, which makes it sound like the people who are leaving, that's already like unlikely. You're already here, so it's very infrequent. And secondly, if you're leaving, right, if you're leaving, you've got no one to talk to out there. So like you're already like lost to the cause. Why are we bending ourselves? And nonetheless, like what I was going to say, we're still concerned that there will be misimpression. They've got no one to talk to out there. They're on their own. I know it doesn't happen a lot, but we're going to make sure this works so that they understand how things function. And then we're going to get to the role of the rabbi, where there's a suggestion that it's true that maybe ordinarily people might leave. They get frustrated if things go long. But if there's an esteemed rabbinic figure in the room, you know, they'll come late because they don't know. But once they're there, the rabbi is going to captivate them or give a kind of sobriety to the event that people are not going to leave. It's going to feel too important to walk out in the middle. So maybe the rabbi being there is going to be a reason why we're not worried and we might stop earlier. So this is all very much still in progress about how Chazal is setting this up, at least as it's described. As we're trying to think about the different factors of what keeps people in, what gives people their interest. So we said already, Lenin, you've got to stand up. Megillah, you can sit down. Lenin, you've got to stand up because you need to give sobriety. Now we're going to say, wait, if there's a rabbi there, maybe it functions differently. And then the responsibility on the rabbi for the atmosphere in shul is also going to be key. And there's going to be the possibility that rabbis don't do tachanun like everybody else. Because we're going to have a story that comes up parenthetically where one rabbi doesn't say a bracha at the end, and we're going to say this is proof that you have four people getting aliyah on Tanit Zibor. And then as parenthetic, he's going to say when he was there, he didn't do tachanun. He didn't bow down like everybody else. Say, why didn't he bow down? And there are going to be three answers, one of which is it's not a good look if rabbis, you know, make a big show of doing tefillah and they don't get answered. Everyone's going to say, oh, I guess he's not such a big rabbi, or I guess this whole prayer thing doesn't work so well. So it's better the rabbis don't engage in performances of prayer if you know it's not going to be responded to, because you're just asking people not to come back. So you've got a huge responsibility if you're kind of a spiritual leader to, number one, recognize people are going to be looking at you. You do shift the atmosphere, you make it more sobriety. Thank you. Make it more, maybe I should drink less in the morning. Make it more sober so people have interest already. They're not going to leave so soon. But you've also got the huge possibility of putting everybody off. You make one bad move, you know, you say, now we're going to say tefillah, 5, 4, 3, God respond, 2, what? Oh, that didn't work, and then everybody leaves, you can make a huge mistake. It doesn't have to be that dramatic. So that's roughly the shape of the daf as we toy with, again, the question, maybe toys to a lighter word, with how do you structure ritual life? Not only in the most ideal way to transmit memory, which was the second chapter, but to keep people engaged and interested and invested in a world where you can't hold them against their will. I'm not suggesting that's an ideal. It's possible Chazal could say, set up shotrim at the door and say, nobody leaves. And the truth is, there are different, I haven't seen any signage here, but there are many shuls that will say, don't come in or don't leave while the rabbi's speaking. And of course, the assumption there is people are going to do it, and you have to put a sign up to create some sort of decorum. People get very upset, like, oh, the rabbi speaking is more important than to feel like Musaf, where people can walk in and out. And it creates all sorts of, but, you know, trying to figure out how to get this working, Chazal invade with it. So, four lines up from the bottom. Barmine Ula Barav Me Rava. Ula Barav asked Rava the following question. Pasha Rosh Chodesh, this is four lines up on Chafala from a bet. Sorry if you don't have it, I'll get through it quickly on to four lines. Parsha Rosh Chodesh, Kesad Karanata, how do we read it? We said three paragraphs, four aliyahs, it's 8, 2, 5. How do you divide up the 8 and the 2? Tzavot b'nei Yisroel mekabel lachmida havin t'manei psukei hechin eved. The first paragraph is 8 psukim. How do you divide that up? It's going to be two aliyahs in some form, or maybe three. You know, the last paragraph, the 5 is going to be one aliyah. You've got three, you have to get between 8 and 2. Nikri tre tlata tlata. Maybe you have two people read three psukim each. So you got 8 psukim, 3 and 3. And how many psukim are left in that paragraph now? 2. Problem. Parshulei tre. That leaves 2 psukim, and that means you finished a paragraph. You finished an aliyah with less than 3 psukim in a paragraph. That's not going to work. Ve'im mesharnshim parashat parchu mesharnshim psukim. That's not going to work. Nikri arba arba. So you say, fine, do 2 psukim. They do 4 each. So 4, 4, then you've got a paragraph of 2, and then you've got a paragraph of 5. Parshula Shiva, that leaves 7 between 2. How are you going to divide the 7 between 2 when you've got 2, and then you've got 5? It's not going to work out. V'yom ha-shabin havin trei, because you got the 2 of the middle paragraph, Rosh Echad Shem havi chamisham, the 5 of the last paragraph. Heichin havin, so what on earth are we going to do? Nikrei trei meha v'chad mehanach. Maybe what you should do is you do the 3, and then you do 3, so you've got 2 psukim left in the first paragraph, and then you're going to read those 2, and then 1 of the next one, which leaves you in a very difficult place, because that leaves you with 1 extra there. None of it works. If you go now to the top of Chaf Bet Ahmed Aleph, Ein matchilim b'parsha b'achom b'shosh psukim, that's not going to work from all directions. You can't only do 1 pasuk from another paragraph, because you're worried someone's going to come in late, as you're finishing up, and they're going to say, oh, you wrapped up an aliyah after 1 pasuk of a paragraph. I guess you only need to do 1 pasuk for each reader. And again, the key is we need to know only 3 psukim. That's the minimum you have to learn, which suggests that context is key. If somebody's sitting in shul, you can only read from the Torah in a context 3 psukim to make sure people don't take things completely out of context. And that's kind of the undergirding logic as to why we're worried about people coming in late or leaving late and thinking, oh, you don't have to do 3 psukim. So maybe what you should do is, you should read the 2 of the middle. So you got 4, then 4. So 2 aliyahs are done now with the first paragraph. Then you've got the 2 and the 5 left. So you say, so do the 2 middle paragraph, and then do the next 3 of the last paragraph, which leaves how many? That leaves only 2 left. Parshulei trei, we're stuck. How do you do this in a way where everybody gets 3 psukim, and you don't start a paragraph and leave less than 3 having been read, and you don't finish a paragraph with less than 3 remaining? We're stuck. Third line down of Chafal Farmabet in the yellow. Amar Lo is the opening. Amar Lo. The response that Rava gave to Ula was, Zulu Shamati, I've not heard a response to this, which makes you wonder, well, what did he do every Rosh Chodesh? And he says, I don't know the proper answer. And, you know, sometimes this happens. A rabbi will get a question, and say, I don't know. Like, I asked you an issue that happens on a relatively regular basis. How do you not have an answer to this? I'm not responsible for everything. I don't pay attention to everything. I remember in yeshiva, I had a question for a yeshiva occasion. I'd ask question something about, you know, how do you bow in modim? Because I've seen different people doing it ways. And one of the Rosh Yeshiva was like, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm like, don't you do it every time you daven? They're like, yeah, but, you know, I was raised. It's not something I spent a lot of time thinking about. So the response of Rava is, I've not heard a formal legislated rule about Rosh Chodesh. I have heard a discussion about a similar subject, about how to divide up Sukkim with a very similar breakdown. Didn't it? It was taught in the Mishnah, fourth line, B'yomar Rishon B'reishit V'yu B'rikia. So, Rashi explains that this is in the context of the Gemara in Tanis that we spoke about 2 years ago, that there were Ma'amadot, meaning just as the priestly population, the Kohanim were divided into Mishmarot, 24 units, and they were on rotation in the Bet Mikdash, the general public was divided into 24 units, those are called Ma'amadot, and they would be present as representatives of the people on rotation in the Bet Mikdash and in the local area. So, one family would, you know, in the same way you get jury service. Have you ever had jury service?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I, for some reason, have never got it. My wife's got it every 3 weeks. She gets a call for jury service. So you would get the Mishmar service, or the, so if you're a Kohen, or a Ma'amad service, you were, if you were a non-Kohen, so that you'd be on rotation and be present. Mm-hmm. And there, part of the routine was, part of your Ma'amad, you would have laning. And it would be a week long, and on day one, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, it would be different laning. So on Sunday, you would read Bereishit, which is Psukim 1 to 5 of Genesis 1. And you would read Vayi Berakia, which was 6 to 7, which is 2 Psukim and 5 Psukim, which adds up to, is that right? Am I missing one? I think that's right. I think maybe it may be 6 to 8 with 3 psukim. Yeah, I think it's 5 and 3. And that can't work either. Then we'll have it. I actually wrote it down. It's 5 and 3. So you've got 5 in the first few psukim, then you've got 3 in the next. That adds up to 8, which is a problem on few levels. It's a problem because how you can divide it up, and you need a minimum of 9, we said. So how do you divide up that there's 3 for every aliyah? Havinam ba, and we were taught, Bishlam yuriki be'achad. I understand you can have a Vehi Berakia, that second paragraph read by one person, because there's 3 psukim. You've got 5, you got 6, 7, and 8 are the 3 psukim you'll read there. But elaborish dutlat psuke havu, because that's 3 psukim. Elaboration bishnayim, chamesh psuke havu, but there are only 5 psukim in that first paragraph. How do you divide that between 2 aliyahs? Vitanya, and we were taught, hakaru b'tari lo yifchot mishosh psukim, you can't have less than 3 for each aliyah. In Ma'alam, we're going to have a debate, and this is going to feed into the discussion about Rosh Chodesh, which we're never actually going to overtly resolve. We're just going to say, this sounds very similar, and you can plug that in as it goes, and we know what we do in Rosh Chodesh now. But this is, again, Rava's response. How do you divide up 5 psukim among 2 people? How would you do that in Rosh Chodesh? But how do you do this during the Ma'amad? Idma la Rav. Rav would say, Dolek, you should skip back, meaning repeat. So you have 5 psukim, you read the first 3, then you read the third one with the next 2, and then you're done. Shmuel Amar Posek. Shmuel says, no, you should split one verse in half. So you read Pasuk 1, 2, and then half of the third, and then you do the second half of the third and the next 2. Which one sounds more elegant of a response to you, just intuitively? The first one to go back?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because you're splitting up a pasuk, it's a little strange.
It's a little strange.
You know, it's a meaning, it doesn't make sense at all.
Oh, that's interesting.
You have a problem with Hashem's name?
Oh, so we're all in on this, that the splitting seems to be less ideal. Interesting. So it seems that our concerns intuitively are more kind of for the text than people coming in and out who might be confused. Like, so you'd be confused, you know, get on with it. We're not going to mess up the text and the grammar and everything so that you're not confused about how many psukim we should read. And we're going to see Rav is so hyper-concerned that people are... I mean, the cynic would say he thinks people don't know what we're reading anyway. So, like, their understanding the psukim and the grammar is not a factor. The factor is, are they going to think we lane 3 or we didn't lane 3? And Shul Life, and this may be the cynical voice in me, does often operate this way. People pay more attention to, you know, the technical details rather than the substance of what we're doing. Like, people are not paying attention necessarily to, like, what's the meaning of the tefillah, but did you say it in the right order? Did you say the right thing for the right day? But maybe that's Rav's logic. So let's continue. This is first one line is Shmuel in the middle. Rav Amar Doleg. Rav who says skip. My Tamala Amar Posek. Why didn't he just say split in the middle? The Gemara begins. That seems like an elegant way so people are not confused about how many psukim you read. Everybody gets three. You get two and a half psukim, and then five, and then three psukim. Everybody gets three psukim. The half being considered a whole verse because it's divided up. He Kasava Kol Psuk Lo Paske Moshe Anlam Paskein Ale. So he comes out with the view you've all had. Sorry, this is Rav. He says, we don't divide up psukim if Moshe didn't. The grammar gets ruined, the context gets ruined, the meaning gets spliced. That's not a pasuk. Moshe tells you what the pasuk is, and we say you've got to do at least three, so you have to go back, skip, like Rav says, and repeat. You can't divide it up. Shmuel amar paskinan le, Shmuel says, split it up. Is that possible? You've just told me the most compelling logic for no compromises. Never divide up anything Moshe didn't. So how can Shmuel allow that? Hamra Chanina Kra, and I know that Shmuel couldn't possibly have allowed that because Chanina, the reader, the used to say a sage, Sar Gadol Hayali Esrav Chanina Gadol. I used to be in great pains next to Chanina Gadol, trying to convince him to let me split up Sukkim because they were too unwieldy. V'lo Hitali Livsok El Tinogashal by Rabban. He said the only time you're allowed to split up Sukkim is when you're in school and you're educating the young and you can divide it up to make it more palatable for the children. Hold it, lamed lai suyun, because that's the only way to teach. So the Gemara says, well, hatam tam amai, what's the reason he allows it in school? If we said you never ever split up something Moshe didn't split up, you can do it in school. Why can you do it in school? Because that's what you need to do. Mishum tal evsha, hachanam el evsha. So here too, Shmuel is going to say, yeah, we're stuck. People are going to be confused out there. And the implicit backdrop to this is you're very worried about children in school getting a misimpression. And Shmuel seems to be very worried about the public getting a misimpression, which suggests an equation between school children and the public. So this is why you might say, oh, you're being very paternalistic. You're being very cynical about the ignorance of the public, how easily misled they'll be. And he would say, yes, I'm being paternalistic. I'm hyper concerned for this tradition. And I it's not condescending that they're like children, but in the business of education, we're all to some degree like children. We lose our focus. We lose attention. We need to be engaged. We're looking for inspiration. We're looking for drama and pizzazz. And that doesn't go away. That's a view of Shmuel, who says, that's why I'm going to divide it in half. I'm hyper concerned. Even though we don't split up anything that Moshe didn't split up. You split it up in school for the kids. I'm going to split it up for the adults. Shmuel Amar Posek, Mayim Lo Abdalek. Why does he say you shouldn't split it? You shouldn't go back and repeat. Why does he say split it up? We're very worried about people coming in and out. That's been implicit we've said so far, but that's just putting it into words. For Shmuel, that's my concern. There are two different concerns. Rav says you can't split up anything Shmuel didn't split up. So I'm just going to repeat because I am worried about people getting a misimpression of not getting three psukim. He's not worried about the impression. He just says you need three psukim each. So I'm going to go back and repeat. Shmuel says I'm very worried about people getting the wrong impression. And if you just repeat, the people who leave, what's the impression? People who leave early. So they hear the first aliyah, there are three psukim read, and then they leave. And there's only two psukim left of that paragraph. And they think, oh, you only need to do two for each aliyah. So very worried about people leaving and getting the misimpression. So he says, you have to repeat so that the people who left, I don't know how it helps them. So I guess it's only for the people who are coming late. The people who come late, right, but the people who come late are now going to think, oh, I guess the first guy only did two psukim because I've just repeated. Oh, that's why Shmuel says posek. Sorry, that's why he says you don't go back and repeat. That's why he says split it in half. I'm very worried about people leaving. So when people all coming in, so when people leave, they think, oh, there's two and a half psukim left, meaning there's three psukim left. And the people come late, say, oh, we start in the middle of the second pasuk. It must be that they had three psukim in the first aliyah. So that's Shmuel's hyper concern. Full stop. Meitve. We're now in the green. It was taught in a brayta. Parsha shel shisha psukim, and we're now going to go back and forth as to whether this is really what could motivate what we should do in Rosh Chodesh, whether you repeat or you skip. Meitve was taught on a brayta. Parsha shishish psukim karinotah b'shnayim. The Mishnah says, this brayta says, if you have a paragraph of six verses, you can divide that into two people, three psukim each. Shel chamisha psukim b'yachid. If there's five, you can't divide it up. You have to have five people. You have one person read all five. And what's the premise here? The premise here, you could have three and then two, right? and then go on. So the assumption is you can't finish a paragraph with less than three, and one person has to do the whole thing. You don't split it up, you don't repeat. So how could we now have Shmuel offering the possibility that you split, and how can I have Rav the possibility that you repeat? The Braisa says straightforward, you have five psukim, only one person gets that aliyah. So the Gemara responds, Vim Eten, if you're right, Vyesha Omrim. No, we're only two lines up. So let's do that again. Maitveh was taught on a bride. You have a paragraph of six verses, two people can read it. Shachamisha can be achil, if you've got five, only one person can read it. Third green line. Karavish and Shlosha, if the first person got an aliyah and they only read three psukim. So there are two left of this five-verse paragraph. Hasheni karashnaim parasha zuv ve'echem parasha acheret. The second person reads two psukim, and then one more pasuk of the next paragraph, so you get to a grand total of three. V'yesh omrim shlosha, and some say you can't read one pasuk of the next paragraph, you have to read three. L'fishen malchin parasha parasha shlosha psukim, because you can't begin a paragraph and not read at least three psukim, because then people who come late are going to think, oh, you only need to do two psukim or one pasuk, because they don't know you started from the previous paragraph. Full stop. That's the end of the bracha. V'im ita, the Gemara says, and if you're right, Rav and Shmuel, that you can divide up the laning during the ma'amad into two and a half and two and a half, or you can do three and then repeat and do three. L'manda ama doleg nidlo, l'manda ama posik nivsok. Why here are they saying, oh, read in the next paragraph? That seems like very straightforward. Why don't you just extend the laning? At which point, nobody says, extend the laning, you insane? Everyone will go insane. That's not the thriban. The shani hatam de'ev shabach. The assumption is that bride is talking about where the topic is still related. So you can read the next paragraph, and it's part of a longer narrative, and it's not a big deal. But on Rosh Chodesh, or on in the Ma'amad, you can't actually, the topic doesn't continue for the first day. On Bereshis or Rosh Chodesh, you read that parasha in Pinchas, you go beyond, it's not talking about Rosh Chodesh in any connected sense anymore. So it's not possible. Amrav Tanchon, Amrav Shuben Levi, Alachok Yesh Omrim. Rav Tanchon says the name of Shuben Levi. By the way, we follow the Yesh Omrim. What did the Yesh Omrim say? That you have to read at least three psukim in a new paragraph. And they seem to be, they are, more machmir than the opening of the Braita. The beginning of the Braita says you've got five psukim, you have to only one aliyah. And if somebody started and read three, so you read two and then one more. And the Yeshomrim said you can't read one more, you have to do three more. So they're more machmir in terms of reading three in a paragraph. And he says, that's a view we follow. And he says, in addition to that, and just if you have to read at least three at the beginning of a paragraph, so too you cannot leave over less than three at the end of a paragraph. So if you start a paragraph, meaning there's five psukim, you can't read three and leave two. You have to leave at least three. Which one they were going to say, pshita, this is obvious, this second ruling. You already said, we follow the Yesh Omrim, that you have to do at least three at the beginning of a paragraph. And they said, oh, and by the way, we also think you have to do, you can't leave less than three at the end of a paragraph, which seems to be the view of the Tanakama. At the beginning, who said, if you have five, one aliyah, you can't divide that up, because we're worried about you leaving only two psukim at the end. Pshita, hashta matchal tzedaka, mekel Tanakama machri Yesh Omrim. So in the beginning, Tanakama, umad chalta just says at the beginning of a paragraph, the Yesh Omrim amol machmeh, they say you have to do three of a new paragraph. In the Tanakama said you only have to do one. Shiyud machmeh Tanakama, in the first part of that brighter, where the Tanakama is machmeh, and say you can't leave only two psukim at the end of a paragraph. Lo kolshken machmeh Yesh Omrim, of course the Yesh Omrim are going to be concerned. And this is where we start playing with what's more worrying, people leaving or coming. Mo detema, you might say nichnas in shchichi. Now actually it's quite common for people to come in late. Yotzin lo shchichi, people don't really leave early. The manche say for Torah v'nafke, they're not going to walk away when laning's happening. They're obviously not familiar with the invention of kiddush clubs. But truth is, even kiddush clubs, they wait. Yeah, it's after laning. They wait for the Torah to be put down or finished and wrapped up. It's not like during Shvi or something. No one walks away from a sefer Torah. You might have thought that. And the Gemara says, kamash malam, which is why we come to teach you to know that even the Yesh Omrim agree with the Tanakama. You may have the view the Tanakama says you can't leave two psukim over, because what might happen? Someone might walk out and think they're only going to do two psukim now. So we're worried about people walking out. The Yesh Omrim might say, I'm not worried about that. I'm only worried about people coming in, which is why you can't start a paragraph and only do less than three. But finishing a paragraph, I'm not worried. No one's going to leave. Kamash Malan, says Reb Tanchum, we are worried people are going to leave. So this is how far Chazal are going to be concerned about an inclusive space that is kind of catering to the least attached of the Jewish people. That they're going to walk out in the middle of the lane. No one leaves a Sefer Torah when it's open. Yeah, they do. And look, it might be, we could be generous and say they got Hatzalah call, they had to run out, and we don't want to leave them with a bad impression. But that's not, seems to be what it's talking about. People walking in and out. And that's the concern for the Tanna Kamma, even that people would do that. But Tanna Kamma, Maishna Shiure Delo Mishum Yotzin, and now the question is, so why does the Tanna Kamma say you can only read, you only have to read one pasuk of the next paragraph? He doesn't seem to care about which group? People who are coming in late. So they'll come in late and they'll hear one pasuk being read or two being read of a paragraph. And they say, oh, I guess you only need one or two pasukim in a paragraph, and they don't know that you start in the previous paragraph. What's his answer? Imre manda ayel shule shayel. When people come in, they'll start asking their neighbors. So he says, I'm not worried about latecomers because people will ask what's going on. And I give more credit to the public that when they're confused, they're not going to on their own think, oh, I guess you only have to read two pesukim. Then they're going to ask and they make inquiries about it. Again, there's a very different psychology about catering to the public. And this happens all the time in public life. Just the latest public crisis that comes to mind is COVID. When I'm sure government officials were trying to decide how much should we share with the public, what kind of instruction should we give the public, are people going to consult with their doctors, are people going to rely on their own assumptions, are people going to do everything we say, and of course you know that when the air clears and the crisis is over, everyone's going to criticize you either way, because you weren't honest enough, or you were too honest and you didn't care about public chaos and disorder. So it's a very complicated question. Chazal entertaining, how much do we care? If people come in late, are we going to start twisting the rules and repeating ourselves and forcing you to lane longer? We already said, Tircha de Tzibur means we're not going to have more aliyahs during the week because we want, and we're not going to make more divisions because people have to go to work. And yet we're going to say you have to read extra psukim, even though it's going to delay you, because we're worried about people coming in late and not talking to their neighbors. Seems to be the conclusion. Shachle rabba breda revolve of Yosef Hiltamai. So what do we do? Shalachle hilchata doleg v'msai dolgan. The bottom line, he says, we don't split up psukim. So we'll repeat. And that seems to be what, and that is what we practice Rosh Chodesh. And it's not clear they're talking about Rosh Chodesh or the Ma'amad here, but that's bottom line what we do. We don't split up psukim. We'll go back and repeat. Question?
We'll presume that he missed a pasuk. The person who leaves early will see how many pasukim are left. So they're not really equal.
Right, so it's very interesting. The assumption on both parts here is nobody's being very imaginative in terms of what happens when they're not in the room. You're right. The assumption is people come late and they don't think, oh, maybe they started in the previous paragraph. They might ask their friends, or they'll conclude, I guess they only did two psukim. No one's going to think, you know what, maybe the world doesn't revolve around me and they read some psukim before I arrived from a previous paragraph. And the people leaving don't think, maybe once I've left, they'll read more of the next paragraph. They think they're just going to finish this paragraph and be done. There seems to be an assumption on the public that only the minimum amount is going to be read because we don't do Tircha de Tzibur. And there's no way they could have started in the previous paragraph. There's no way they're going to go past this paragraph. You're right. There is narcissism is perhaps too strong a word, but there is certainly a blinkers on the imagination here where we're not assuming people are going to kind of think laterally about the possibilities. Again, paternalistic is maybe too strong, but there is hyper concern among Chazal that what is the worst-case scenario of the average person's reaction? And how do I make sure that tefillah is structured to cater for their worst-case scenario, least engaged person's conclusions, to make sure that this is maximally transmitted? So we said this last time, that the premise seems to be of this whole chapter is that Jewish outlook is premised on being as inclusive as possible. So if you think about different models of community, the more insular and exclusive, the more open-armed and open-doored, Chazal seemed to be painting that picture here, where the forest-flung Jew needs to be thought about in terms of how we're designing shul life so that we can transmit memory reliably and that we can inject hope into the community generally. In theory, we could just say, let's get the group of the 10 most committed Jews and forget everybody else, and we'll make this work and we'll keep transmitting and we'll move it through the ages, and we could all speculate as to why Chazal think that's not the option, either because it's not the ideal or because who knows, you know, of the 10, maybe 5 will go into tragedy. We just need to increase our numbers. So whether it's pragmatic or ideological, Chazal seem to be hyper-focused on being as inclusive in terms of our worries as possible. Seth?
Do you assume that they have access to some type of printed Chumash, or that the people know it by heart and they know the paragraphs by heart?
Oh, so that is interesting. So there seems to be an assumption people do not have access generally to a text, which is one of the explanations for why there's a repetition of the Amidah to get people fluent or get people to hear. But there is an assumption, Seth is right, that we assume everybody knows where the paragraphs begin and end. They come in late and they hear two psukim being written and said, oh, that's interesting. The paragraph ends two psukim earlier, so I guess we only do two psukim. So we are assuming a huge amount of fluency combined with a huge amount of ignorance on how ritual life works. So I hadn't thought about it in those terms. But yeah, Chazal are imagining the most educated textual public with the least educated ritual public, which is a divide that often happens. If, you know, you spend your life in yeshiva, I've seen this at weddings a lot. You have a Rosh Yeshiva who has an audience of hundreds of people giving Talmud Shirim, and then under the chuppah turns to, you know, the ignorant pulpit rabbi and says, what do we do now? You know, I've been in the lab, but I don't know how we do this in practice. So and it seems to be Chazal say, you know, everyone can be maximally educated. And it's not assuming the average person per se, but saying, let's think about the worst case scenario. It would be the person who's most educated about how this works is going to have bad conclusions about how to transmit it. So it's an interesting balance. People who don't have the fluency, we're not worried about. So it is an interesting, it's even more narrow worry about a division of textual fluency not aligned with ritual practice. Interesting. Yeah.
I just want to say that the assumption of people being far-flung or not as serious or whatever, we're assuming that there's time. Like, you know, Shabbos starts at 9:15, whatever it is. The people walk in at 9:25, they know they're late. I'm not sure that was the case then in the sense that there were no clocks.
Right.
So, you know, they showed up, the sun kind of looks like it's, you know, they may not realize they're walking in.
Precision wasn't an option, is what you're saying anyway. But yeah, so
it might not be a function of seriousness or far flung or, you know, not as.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so, right, maybe it's not about commitment levels. Which is interesting. I mean, the people leaving, that might be a function of less commitment, leaving early. But that is interesting generally you wonder if they couldn't like send out a WhatsApp and say what time Shacharis is or put it on a bulletin, how'd anybody get there at the same time? And our assumption presumably is that people were far more attuned to the natural rhythms of time than we are because we rely on machines all the time. And presumably I imagine we all remember life before cell phones. You know, you had meetings and people managed to meet. And, you know, it wasn't like, but I can't tell them I'm 3 minutes late. What am I going to do? People tended to compensate and we've become far more reliant. So it's possible that precision was possible within minutes. But it's an interesting observation. Okay. In the gray. Zeh klal, kol sheyesh bo musaf. So this goes back to the mission of the previous staff who says, whenever there is musaf, you have 4 aliyahs. And now the Gemara is going to spend the next half daf, Amud, as we call it, talking about, what about a public fast day? That's the only thing not discussed in the Mishnah. We've got Monday, Thursday discussed, we've got Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed discussed, Yom Tov, Yom Kippur and Shabbos, but nothing about Tanit Sibur. So Ibailu, they ask the following question. Tanit Sibur Bukama, how many aliyahs are there on a public fast day? Rosh Chodesh, Umoed, Dika Korba Musaf, Arba'ah. Is it that on Rosh Chodesh Chol HaMoed, where there is Musaf, you have 4 aliyahs of Al-Hachad, Leika Korba Musaf, Lo, but there's no Korba Musaf in a public fast day, so you only have 3. Odilma, or maybe Hachanami Ika Musaf Tfila. There is a Musaf on a public fast day. What Musaf is there? What extra thing is there on the fast day? What do I announce? You know, please remember to insert. Anenu. So there's an addition. It's not a korban musaf and it's not a tefillah musaf, but there is an extra prayer. Is that enough to warrant an extra aliyah? And then this again speaks to the question of how do you communicate import through ritual gestures to the public? Do I need to add something to communicate this is an extra special day or not? And if not, so how different is a public fast day? Tashma was taught. We learned in our Mishnah. Baruch HaKadosh V'Chol HaShem Karin Arba. during Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, you read four. That implies Habatan it's Zibur Gimel. It says explicitly when you have four, and that's Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, so presumably not Chol HaMoed. Eimer Resha, but at the same time, in the previous sentence, the Mishnah said, B'shen v'chamisha b'shabbos mincha karen gimel. It says on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos afternoon, you read three. And that's it. Ha, Tanit Tzibur Arba, which implies that there are four in Tanit Tzibur. It's stuck in the middle. There are the firm, explicit mentions of when you get three and when you get four. Both exclude Tanit Tzibur. So which one implies which? Elamahacha lekele mashmale. So the Gemara says, well, you can't really imply from the fact it says Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos you have three that it excludes Tanit Tzibur. And you can't really imply from the fact that it says you Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed you have four. We're stuck. Where do we go? Tashmai was taught. We're now going to have a story. The Rav, not a very long or complicated story. The Rav Igla Labavel B'Tanit Tzibur. Rav went to Babylon, to Bavel, on a public fast day. Kankrab Sifra, he was called to the Torah to read. Patach Baruch, when he began, he said a bracha, meaning Berchat la Torah. Chatim lo Baruch, and at the end, he didn't say a bracha. Napol Kule Alma Anpaihu, and then after the laning, everybody fell on their faces for Tachanun, for Rav Lanavel Ape, but Rav didn't do Tachanun, and we'll come back to that in the second half of the next Amud. But the first focus is he got up, gave an aliyah, and he didn't say Bracha at the end. What's the implication of that? Someone's coming after him. Now, we're trying to figure out how many aliyahs there are on a fast day. Michti, let's see. Rav Yisrael Kra. We know Rav was a Yisrael, so presumably he got the third aliyah. And he didn't say bracha at the end. That implies, someone's going to read after him. Ah, it must be there are four aliyahs on a Tanit Tzibur. Lo, no. Rav Bagani Kra. Maybe Rav got called up for the Kohen aliyah, which by everyone says, but hold on, he's not a Kohen. Ah, Daharav Huna Karibad Berkahani, because we know Rav Huna, who wasn't a Kohen, often got called up for the Kohen aliyah, because he was such a significant figure with such reverence. People said, all the Kohanim are Mochel, and he should have the aliyah, because he's such an inimical Tamil Chacham. Bishlama, last of the middle lines. Bishlama Rav Huna Kareba Kani. It makes sense that Rav Huna would get the Kohen. Taha Afila Rav Ami Rav Asi. The Kani Chashev Yadot Yisrael may give coffee Leila Rav Huna. Well, it makes sense Rav Huna would get the Kohen because even the greatest Kohanim, the biggest Talmidei Chachamim who were Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Ami Rav Asi, they would defer to Rav Huna. So it makes sense that every Kohen in the country would defer to Rav Huna and he would get that Aliyah. Ala Rav, now we're going to get into the which rabbi is good and who respects who. Rav, Ha'ika Shmuel Dekana Hava, Shmuel was a Kohen. V'davar Aleh, and he would, Rav would defer to Shmuel. So if he would defer to Shmuel, he can't get the Kohen Aliyah, and therefore he must have had Shlishi, which means there's an Aliyah after him, which means there are four on a Tanit Tzibur. No, the Gemara said three lines up. Shmuel nami mekev havakafet. Le Shmuel actually deferred la Rav. For Rav havavid le kavet, but Rav would refuse to let him defer to him. V'chi avid le b'fanav shalom b'fanav lavi le. But he only would do that in front of him. He wouldn't insist on deferring to Shmuel in his absence, but Rav insisted to defer to Shmuel. That was part of his greatness, is that he refused to let Shmuel defer to him. But if Shmuel's not in the room, we all know that Shmuel really would defer to Rav, so Rav can get the Kohen Aliyah. Which means that this doesn't prove that there are four aliyahs on a Tanit Tzibur. Hachinam is done with the Rav Bakani Kran. The Gemara says two lines up, and actually it makes a lot more sense that Rav got the Kohen Bracha. Why? Because we said he didn't say Bracha afterwards, but he did make a Bracha at the beginning. And we already said you don't make a Bracha in the middle aliyah. You only make it at the beginning of the first aliyah, at the end of the last aliyah. Disal Kadag B'Yisrael Kran, Lefanei Mai Baruch. Why is he making Bracha at the beginning if he's getting the Yisrael? The Gemara says, La'acha Takana. Oh no, it's after we made the Takana that everybody says a Bracha before and after. At which point you say, well, hold on, he didn't make a bracha. Then he should have made a bracha afterwards. So either it's before the takana and he's getting Kohen. Otherwise, why is he making the bracha? Or it's after the takana and why isn't he saying a bracha at the end? We're kind of stuck. At which point the Gemara says, ah, Shani Hechadiyativ Rav is different when Rav was there. Or when a great rabbi is in the room. That maybe when a rabbi is in the room, what are we not concerned people are going to do? We're not worried they're going to walk out. So you don't have to have a bracha at the end because they're going to stay all the way to the end of the laning to know you have a bracha at the end. But they might still come late. They're going to come late, but they're not going to leave early if the rabbi's there. And therefore, even after the takana, where we say everyone has to do a bracha before and after because people are going to be confused when they leave, when a great rabbi's there, no one's going to leave. So the takana kind of falls away, which already injects again flexibility into these hardcore takanas. We're very worried about people leaving. Oh, but I guess if there's a, you know, exigent circumstances where you're not worried, you don't have to make an extra bracha. It's what it sounds like. Okay, top of the page. We're still trying to figure out how many aliyahs you have in a fasting. Tashma was taught, Zeh klal, this is a general, kol sheyesh bo bitul melacha la'am, whenever there is a possibility of taking away people's work, kugon tanit sibra tisha b'av, like tanit sibra and tisha b'av, where people are working, it sounds like. Korin gimol, you have only three aliyahs, which resolves our problem straightforwardly. How many aliyahs are on the fast day? We've just been told there are three. Shein bo bitul melacha la'am, and when there is no bitul melacha, meaning no one's going to work anyway, in Rosh Chodesh and v'chol ha'moed, no one's working in Rosh Chodesh or v'chol ha'moed, it sounds like, which is an interesting inversion, because I think if you were to ask the average person, is it more likely someone will be working on Tisha B'Av or Rosh Chodesh? I might be wrong, but my guess is more people take off for Tisha B'Av than they do for Rosh Chodesh. That be accurate?
Rosh Chodesh women didn't work, that was the custom.
Right. So, So it seems to be the nature of the day is such that there was a practice among women not to work, so it was a more significant day. But you might think, well, the women aren't working, so the men have to work even harder to keep the income. And that's what we're worried about in shul, that people are going to have bitul malacha. Or maybe it's for the women in shul. It's true, there is an interesting discussion here about who's not working on Rosh Chodesh and why would it matter if it's only the women who are not working, etc. Karin Dala, but you read four. You have four aliyahs in Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed. Shmar Menah, sounds like we can learn from here. Straightforward answer, even though our Mishnah didn't mention it, we've got this klal, this general rule that tells us when laning happens. I'm Ravashi, v'ha'anan lotanen hachi, but that's not the general rule in our Mishnah, says Ravashi. Our Mishnah does give a general rule. Our Mishnah says on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos afternoon you have three. It says Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, you have four, and then right after it says Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, you have four. It says Zeh HaKlal. This is the general rule, and this is what it says: Zeh HaKlal. Kol Yom Sheyesh Bo Musaf Ve'Eino Yom Tov Karin Ba'arba. Whenever there is Musaf and it's not a Yom Tov, you read four. What does that sound like? Letu Yemai. What is this extra rule coming to include? Love Letu Tanit Sibra Tisha B'Av. Surely that's coming to or exclude or include Tanit Sibra Tisha B'Av, saying only when there's Musaf and it's not a Yom Tov, you have four. Sounds like our Mishnah is suggesting, it does include Tisha B'Av and Tanit Tzibur, because there is Anenu, there's an extra prayer, and that's what this Zeh HaKlal in our Mishnah seems to be included. Alu Ravashi Manita Mani, but Kunda Ravashi, who just said the Zeh HaKlal, the general rule on Mishnah, includes on a Tanit Tzibur, you have four aliyahs, who's our Mishnah following? Lo Tanakam of Rabbi Yossi. It's not Tanakam or Rabbi Yossi in the following Braita, who both say you only have three aliyahs on Tisha B'Av. The Tanya was taught in a Braita, Chali Yos B'Shen V'Chamishi Karin Gimel Mavde Echad. When Tisha B'Av falls on a Monday or Thursday, you have three aliyahs and one Mavde, one Haftorah. Shlishi Revi, if it falls on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, Karin Echad Mavde Echad, you have only one aliyah that covers all three, as opposed to three aliyahs, so we don't break it up too much. Rabbi Yossi says, we don't follow the Tanakama, there's always three aliyahs on Tisha B'Av, whatever day it falls. So they both agree, there's always three aliyahs on Tisha B'Av, suggesting there's only three aliyahs on a Tanit Sibra. So who, for Rav Ashi, is our Mishnah following, when it implies that on a Tanit Sibra there are four aliyahs? El Akasha Zeh HaKlal. What are we going to do with Zeh HaKlal? So I guess what we're going to say instead is, Lola Atuya Rosh Chodesh HaMoed. It's coming to include, when it says Zeh HaKlal, whenever there is a Musaf and not a Yom Tov, you read four. That includes that on Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed you have four aliyahs. At which point the Gemara says, but the Mishnah just said that out loud. Why would you need a general rule to include that? At which point the Gemara says, Habehejiktani la Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed Karin Arba. It says outright that you do that. Simonaba Alma Yahiv. The general rule is repeating this fact to give you a mnemonic, because we're worried you're going to lose track in the moment without this principle at hand, and we need to say outright what we're including. So we say there is on Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed four aliyahs. Zeh HaKlal, this is the rule. And it's not to include anything else new, it's just to give you the reasoning for the two facts we've just said about Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, so you don't get confused, and this is it. Delo Tema Yom Tov Chol HaMoed Ki Hadinenu. You shouldn't think to yourself, Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed are probably the same, and therefore, you know, you're there on a Chol HaMoed and you're about to do Leining. You think, I think we have to do five aliyahs. Say, why? Well, we did on Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed is kind of like Yom Tov. So it says, that's why the Mishnah says Zeh HaKlal. This is the rule. If it's not Yom Tov, there's only four. Alanakot HaKlal B'Yadach. Take this general rule again. Kol Tfele Milta B'Chavrei Tfele Gav Yatre. Whenever a day has something additional to it, you get an extra aliyah. Hilkach, therefore, Rosh Chodesh Chol HaMoed Ikam Kurban Musaf Karin Arba. The baseline on a Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos is three. But if you have Musaf, you have four. But Yom Tov does be says Malacha. On Yom Tov, the extra thing is a ban on work. You have five. But Yom Kippur da onish kare shisha. On Yom Kippur, where if you break it, you get kare. You have six. Shabbos tiki is a skila shiva. On Shabbos, the only time where there is a capital punishment for breach, you have to have seven aliyahs. Full stop. So, bottom line, how many aliyahs are there on Tanit Tzibur? Three. And we say the implication of our Mishnah that there is four from Zeh HaKlal, that's just to repeat the idea of Rosh Chodesh Chol HaMoed so you don't get confused. Bottom line, there is a gradation, which again is about how do you communicate to the public the significance of the day, how many aliyahs there are, and we balance with how do you deal with when you can't split it up, cut the topic, etc., etc. Let's just do another 3 minutes. Gufa. Let's go back for a second. We told a story about Rav being in Bavel, which told us, or seemed to tell us, how many aliyahs on a Tanit Tzibur, because he didn't say bracha at the end, he was shlishi, presumably it was four. In the end, we said, that's not a proof. He was probably called up for Cohen, because he was the most significant rabbi. And that makes more sense, because he says a bracha at the beginning and not the end. And then we said, well, no, maybe not. Maybe in the story he was shlishi, and there was someone afterwards. And the reason he didn't say bracha at the end was because we're not worried about people leaving when there's a great rabbi there. In the end, he said that wasn't conclusive, so we used another proof to make the point. But that story is left in the air. So, Gufa, let's go back. Rav Ikla the Bavel B'tanit Tzibur, Kam Krab Sifra. Rav went to Bavel on this fast day. He read from the Torah, Pasuk Baruch Atam Lo Baruch. He said a bracha at the beginning, not at the end. Ignore that piece for now. Nipul Kule Alma Anpayu. Everybody fell on their faces for Tachanun. Rav Lo Nabal Anpe. Rav did not. My Tam Rav Lo Nabal Anpe. Why did Rav not say Tachanun with everybody else? And we're now going to have three possible answers why Rav didn't say Tachanun while everybody else did. Number one, Rispa Shalavanim Haita, it was a stone floor. Now, what do we do during Tachanun? Tachanun is meant to be Nefilat Apayim. What does Nefilat Apayim literally translate as? Falling of the face. If you were to ask a general person, what do we do during Tachanun? What gesture would they say? Yeah, the arms involved. That seems to be the key. The key for Tachanun is not the arm. The key is the face. But we'll put our arm there. Why do we have the arm there? It's exhausting. So the arm is there to separate your face from the floor. So again, so there's no insistence. A lot of times people think you have to lean on it. It's not about leaning, it's about blocking. So you can put your arm down there. It's meant to just be blocking your face so you're not leaning over a stone floor. It's kind of a gesture toward the prohibition to bow on stone floors. And we'll see this a lot in Rosh Hashanah where people pass things out when everyone's going to bow down on the floor. People put down a like a mat or something. A lot of times people put it under their knees because they think, oh, it's to stop me from hurting my knees or something. The general problem is your face being next to the floor, so it should be laid down so that when you lie, it's under your face, so your face isn't toward the floor. Turns out that we're going to see that only applies to a stone floor. So if it's carpeted, you don't need anything anyway, unless you're planning to do a full hands out, legs out, lying on the floor, which I have seen only once. In my life on Yom Kippur, somebody do that, and it looks odd, but I've seen somebody do that, and we're about to see that somebody else had that practice. So, again, three reasons why Rav didn't do Tachanun while everybody else was doing Tachanun and Bavel. Number one, Rispa Shalavaram Haite, it was a stone floor of a tongue, and we taught Evan Mashkit, Lotin Ubarzachan Mashalavad Aleh. There is a verse that says, stone floor, you shall not put in your land to bow upon. Aleh Ayyete Mashalavad Ba'arzachem, you shouldn't lie upon it, Ba'arzachem. Excuse me, in your land, so you're allowed to bow on the stone in the Bet Mikdash, but you can't in the general public. And that's why Rav didn't bow down, Kudu'ullah, as Ullah says, you can't bow down on stone floors. And that's why Rav couldn't bow down for Tachanun. Any questions? Yeah. Okay, so why is Rav special? If you look on the Nami, no one should be in Tachanun if it's a stone floor, no one should be bowing down. Kame de Rav Avai. No, it was stone floor just in front of Rav. And sometimes you'll have this. You'll be in a room and it's carpeted and there's one area where it's tiled or something. And there was a stone area where Rav was. So he didn't do Tachanun. What could he have done? Take a step to the right or to the left. So walk a little bit in the room. And sometimes, you know, you'll have this. You'll be at a minyan and people sit for Tachanun. And there's a chair like over there. And you're standing here, and to get to the chair, you're going to have to say, excuse me, or walk past people. So you're going to walk past and sit, or you're going to stand up and do it where you're standing. So Rav said, look, people are all there. I'm not going to like say, get out the way so I can bow on the floor. I'm just going to stand here while everybody bows. So what would be the lesson of this story then, when it says Rav didn't bow down? is not ma'akev if what is in the way, what's significant enough to stop you from it? Yeah, tircha, bothering other people. So that seems to be the value for this first answer. The stress that Rav didn't do tachanun was because he happened to be where there was stone floor near him, not near anybody else, and he said, you know what, me bowing down is less important than me not interrupting the public. Even though it may lead to confusion, they're going to see me not bowing down, but they'll notice because of the stone floor, and they'll think, why didn't he come over here? I guess he didn't want to bother us. Full stop, but there are two other answers, because that's not entirely satisfactory. He seems to be oblivious to the fact that other people think, oh, I guess you don't have to bow down, or not. Ibaidim, alternative. Rav Pishu Yadan Reb Laim Avod. Rav had a practice when he would do tachanun, he wouldn't just bow his face toward the floor like the average person does, he would fully prostrate. He would have his hands out flat and his legs out flat, just lie flat on the floor. Even in movies, you don't see people bowing to royalty like that, right? You ever see that when people bow to royalty, they get on their knees and they bow. I haven't seen an impression of people with their legs out flat and their hands out flat. But what is the purpose of bowing before someone? Why does it show respect? This is like an odd thing to do. Why would that show respect?
You're lower than.
So I can bow my knees. So why? What is this? Again, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but some assume the way you show respect is making yourself vulnerable. You say, I'm willing to put myself at risk. And you go like that. It's basically saying, shove a sword in my head, cut my head. Like if you see, again, we're not monkeys, but in the monkey world, the way an ape shows deference to the leader of the pack is... But essentially, if you've ever seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I don't know how accurate that is, but generally they tend to offer their palm. You lose your hand in the monkey world, you're dead. You can't climb trees, you can't fight, you can barely walk. It's a way of saying, you're in charge and I'm willing to let you do whatever you need to do. So if bowing is about vulnerability, I could see why, like long arms, long feet, that's you can't move. If you're on your knees, you can spring to action. You just lie flat on the floor, your way of saying, I'm at your complete disposal. So I can see that being the most vulnerable. And Rav used to do that for Tachanun. And it was a stone floor. And everybody had a stone floor, but everybody else was comfortable, you know, going like that over the stone floor, because the prohibition is only to have a full prostration on a stone floor. So Rav didn't want to lie down. It wasn't like he could walk over there. And you're right, Tircha Ditzibra wouldn't have been enough to be ma'akev and to not be ma'akev and say you shouldn't disturb everybody and just stand there. He would have said, excuse me, Megrim, I'm coming over here to do Tachanun, but he couldn't. The whole thing was a stone floor, and he used to prostrate himself flat out, and he would rather stand up than bow on the floor, which there's a prohibition to do. Which one, the Gemara says, you can meet him halfway. Why don't you just do what everybody else is doing, which is bow your face down? So don't lie yourself all the way out. Do what everybody else is doing. Lomashanim Minhage said, I'm not changing my practice. And this is also an astonishing confession of not obliviousness, but a lack of interest in how other people will see. If I'm the public and I'm standing in the room with Rav, what do I see? I see him not doing Tachanun. Am I going to think, oh, I guess his practice is he lies fully prostrate and it's a stone floor and he's not going to change his minhag? Or am I going to think, I guess you don't have to do this for Tachanun? So you've got an interesting balance of how much ignorance do we assume people have? How much curiosity do we assume people have? How many conclusions are they going to draw on their own? And Rav seems to be in a view. Well, again, Rav was the one who said Rav was the one saying we skip back because we're very worried we're not worried about what people think. We're worried more about everyone getting three whole psukim. Shmuel was the one who said we have to divide it up. We're very worried about people coming in, coming out. And Rav seems to be embodying that again. People will be fine. They have questions, they'll ask, and if they're confused, it's not my problem. I'm not changing my minhag. I'm not going to disturb them, so I've got a lot of respect for people's space and concentration, but what I'm doing is my business, and everyone's on their own. And again, you could spend more time than we have trying to plot out the psychological landscapes or the imaginations of ritual life to all these different rabbinic figures. So that was option two, and we'll finish. Ibaid Ema, Adam Chashav Shani. We'll finish this with this. Third possibility why Rav didn't bow down during Tachanun is not because it was a stone floor and not because the stone floor was everywhere and he had a special minhag to bow down all the way, but he's an important person to Rav Elazar and he held like Rav Elazar. And there was a view that, according to the name of Rav Elazar, if you're an important person, you should not do bowing down unless you are 100% answered.
And how often can you be confident you will be 100% answered? Zero. So he would never do Tachna. As we know from Yeshua ben Nechtiv, it says in the book of Joshua, V'yomashav li'Yeshua kum lech. This is against the backdrop where Yeshua bows down after there's been some tragedy, and God says, get up. And you could read that as God says, oh, thank you for bowing down, now you may rise. But the way it's understood is he says, no. I'm not answering you now. And if you bow down and prostrate yourself and you don't get the answer you're looking for, everyone's going to lose faith in you and lose faith in prayer. Just get up. Don't bow down. So the assumption is, Rav would never bow for Tachanun, because it was the assumption that rabbis don't do this because it's a bad look. And again, what are people going to think? Rabbis don't have to pray? It raises all sorts of other questions as we're trying to balance this out. What we'll get to next time, starting from this orange, is the different kinds of bowing and how people used to bow in different ways. But in the meantime, I thank you for your attention. And we'll not meet next week. I will be in an airport at this time next week. But in 2 weeks' time, we will meet. I wish you all a successful week and meaningful day.